moved.
Our story and study today comes from the book of Exodus, chapter 1, verses 15 through 19, and chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, if you are so inclined to follow along. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live. But the midwives knew God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and allowed the boys to live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. Now, a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him for 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got the papyrus basket for him and plastered it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the river. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her attendants walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to bring it. When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. This must be one of the Hebrews' children, she said. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go get you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you? Pharaoh's daughter said to her, yes. So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she took him as her son. Pharaoh's daughter named him Moses, because, she said, I drew him out of the water.
So at about 5:30 this morning, I sat down to look at the sermon I had prepared. And I thought, you know, this is a pretty good sermon about controlling reproduction and about crafty women, about hope. But as I sat with it and I sat with how I've spent my last couple of days, I decided to delete it and start over. I'm looking at Steve because he's been with me for part of it, and Pastor Hannah. It's been a week of hospitalizations, of members moving into hospice care. And yesterday we've had the first funeral we've had in 18 months, that of Kermit Dirks, in this space. And when you're in those transition moments, those moments of moving into death, which none of us know how to do because none of us have done it before, when you're in those moments of mourning, at least for me, sometimes Sunday morning can feel artificial. Or at least I worry. I worry that coming here, given what we experience everywhere else, that it can feel artificial, which isn't a new sensation for me. It's a question mark I always have. Having an order of worship like we do, which is pretty loose, relatively speaking, on our branch of the Christian family tree, we develop that order of worship rather than having an open service, or more Pentecostal style, or more Holy Roller style. We have that order of worship for a reason. It's intentionally artificial. We create these liturgies. We've inherited them over centuries, these rhythms of words and order of events, because humans need ritual. All human cultures have shown a need for ritual. There's something about people that needs ritual. We need ritual to take us out of the ordinary. I mean, I don't see any other place like this in my life. Getting to come here in this kind of space takes me out of the ordinary. And ritual, too, helps import meaning into the ordinary. It helps us assess if there is meaning, look to find meaning in our ordinary lives that are so short. And that's good. I wouldn't be here if that wasn't so good. But sometimes, given everything that we've been up against, we're in the sixth month of the second year of this pandemic. We have witnessed the intense destructive power of the forces of nature. I don't know if you guys are Weather Channel watchers, as we aren't. Yep, Barbara. Okay. Don. Dinah. Oh, Bob's narking out Dinah. Nice. You know, what used to be a rare event of, you know, a storm watch is now here's today's storm watch. Here's today's fire watch. Here's how the smoke is disrupting weather all across the West. And then in one of my old neighborhoods in Vancouver, Washington this week, white supremacists shut down the elementary schools. In the midst of all we're going through, sometimes this artificial structure can seem insufficient to me. And I worry that it might be tone deaf. Have you ever had that experience, like gotten up of a Sunday morning or even gone to bed on Saturday night with just like a big question mark in your body? Like, is that where I need to put my energy tomorrow? Will that meet me where I'm at tomorrow? Do I have anything to bring to anything to offer tomorrow? Yeah. But what keeps me coming back, in addition to all of you, and this is a precious church, this church is one of a kind, truly a one of a kind church when it comes to acknowledging the beauty of bodies, the freedom found in the Spirit, and our commitment to make that true for all people, even if it means some of us have a lot to give up. In addition to all of you, what brings me back here are these stories, like the one Pastor Hannah read today. These stories that, even though they are thousands of years old and from places so different than ours, sound exactly like what we are up against to this day. So let's look at our characters today. And I use that word characters very intentionally. There isn't yet any factual historical evidence that anything that happened in Exodus factually historically happened. And the Egyptians kept really good records of their slaves and everything else, which tells me that these are characters that have been lovingly, with deep need, preserved, crafted, emerged, and preserved because they said something important to generations. And part of what they say to me is that we have endured trauma for a long time as humans. These are characters, these are women who are enduring trauma. They are going through a horror. We didn't read all of chapter one, but we hear that Pharaoh, even though the Hebrew people have been part of Egypt for generations, and that's tied into the Joseph Technicolor Dreamcoat story, even though the Hebrew people have been in Egypt for generations, somehow this Pharaoh has forgotten that they are his people, perceives them as animalistic, perceives them as vermin, wants to squash their reproduction, wants to keep them from having any power, wants to make sure they are only recognized as other and as not human. And so he keeps doing things to try to crush their will. Slave labor, hard labor. Then this announcement that the midwives who serve Hebrew women need to take a newborn infant if it's male, if it presents as male, and kill it. And if they don't get there in time, anytime they see a male child, throw it in the river. This is trauma. This is a horror. Earlier this week, Pastor Hannah and I put out an invitation to the parents, grandparents, and guardians in our congregation who have school-aged children, saying, come together if you need. Last year, I think people tried to rally. This year, for people with school-aged children, there is no rallying left. It sounds like not just male children, but whole families have just been thrown into dangerous waters with no support, with no care. As if school shootings had not been enough for parents, teachers, and guardians to deal with. The stress and the fighting over masks and racism. The grief over what their kids lost last year and what they don't yet have this year, I think, is suffocating, more so than these masks. And these parents have no mentors. These parents, grandparents, and guardians have no mentors for what they're going through because they're forging this unheralded parental path. Leah, I'm thinking about the kids that you see in your care and what those parents must be like. Leah does speech therapy, so you've seen that. So it's not just the parents, it's those of you who are in contact with kids, including the kids who are 18 and 19 years old in our university. These parents, grandparents, and guardians make me think of the mother of Moses, who I call Mother Moses, who are trying to weave together a protective vessel, but still have to place their child into waters that could easily drown. So she has this protective vessel, but what can she do but put it into waters that could easily drown? And then there are school-aged children themselves who are not oblivious to what's going on around them. These kids see adults in their nation giving everything, time, money, and passion to protect the so-called unborn, and doing nothing, it seems, to protect whole populations of children who are very much born. Which makes me think about Miriam. So she isn't named in today's passage, this sister of Moses that we heard about. But we know from later stories in Exodus that Moses has two older siblings at least, Aaron and Miriam. Now, I don't think Aaron is in this story because he's a boy. He had to remain in hiding. Someone could have just chucked him in the river to kill him. And Mother Moses couldn't be there to watch over this child in the river because once the baby cries, she's going to start lactating, and everyone's going to know what's going on. So Miriam, a kid, like our kids in this church, is left to watch the future of her baby sibling, whether it be drowning or salvation. Then we have Shipra and Pua, these midwives. And to me, I like to read them as not having any fear in the face of danger. So they get charged by the only power in the state, right? This is a totalitarian state. This is Pharaoh's land. And Pharaoh charges them to kill all the male Hebrew babies. And obviously they fail to do so because Pharaoh asks them, well, what happened? You know, why aren't you doing what I told you to do? And I like to picture Shipra and Pua kind of shrugging their shoulders and playing off of Pharaoh's stereotypes and be like, gosh, sir, these Hebrew women, they're just so good at birthing babies, we can't get there in time. Gosh. How hard was it for them to keep a straight face? You know, because sometimes power can be rendered really stupid by its bigotry. The story suggests that Shipra and Pua evidenced this fearlessness because they knew God. It says that they knew God. To me, that's suggestive of a deep knowing, that they had a profound reverence for the divine. And it let them live with whatever fear they had about what Pharaoh would rightly do to them in his mind in order for them to do what they believed was right. And then finally, we have this princess who's obviously not part of the ancient Israelite community, but something allowed her to go against power and to directly contradict her father's own dictates in choosing to adopt this Hebrew male. When I picked this story, it's because I thought, you know, we're going to do this cycle of birth, death, and new life, and here's one of our most famous birth stories. Okay, Labor Day weekend, we'll do Moses. And while this week with Steve and with Pastor Hannah and with others in hospital, in the funeral, at the burial, and in hospice, I was very mindful about how birthing is always happening, even in dying. That storytelling of ours, that awareness of ours, doesn't mean that the losses we experience aren't scary and that they don't hurt a lot. And I don't think our birth stories are intended to poo-poo those of our deaths. I know we live in a culture where if someone dies, someone will say, oh, that's God's will, or whatever it is, because we're afraid to sit with powerful pain and afraid to let it run its course, whatever that course may be. I don't think that's the intent of our stories. But it's a different question I'm bringing. This is what I'm bringing into the story today, which is different than what you're all bringing. The question I bring to this story and the question I bring to us as the community gathered around this story and others is, what is the role of ritual? What has been the role of ritual when there is collective oppression and trauma? What is the role of our religious ritual when there is collective oppression and trauma? Ritual, religious ritual, can be about a lot of things. It can be about control. It can be about domination. It can be about trying to make sure that there's at least one outcome that we can predict. But ritual can also be about providing some stability and steadiness in a time of chaos. You know what to expect here. And there's some real, okay, we're doing the passing of the peace. We've got the prayers of the people. At least this is still true. I don't know what's going to happen at the grocery store. But at least today, I know Sonny's going to play piano. I'm going to hear some scripture. And I'm going to see some familiar eyes around me. But the women of this story, and I think most of us in the rest of our lives today, have very little control, very little ability to predict the outcomes of our days and our lives. The birthing work of these women is sewn together in the story so beautifully to show that Moses makes it, but in each of those steps, those women couldn't have predicted that. They didn't. We have no reason to believe they knew about the others doing their birthing work. An infant that is not killed on one day could have easily been killed on the next. A future that is set afloat can be picked up, or that future can be capsized. Were they able to be so strong, so creative, so innovative, so generative because of their religious tradition, because of their religious ritual, because of their equivalent of Sunday story and study, and have our rituals in this place given us that kind of life-saving creativity in the midst of today's dangers and chronic uncertainty? Because we're in this very story right now. Right now, there is an idea. There's an idea out there that could be the saving of all of us that is under threat. Right now, there is a child. There are millions of children having to do the work of adults. Right now, someone close to power is primed for an act of subversion. I don't know why each of you came here today. I don't know why you come each week or each month, but I do pray over the reason. I pray on my knees. I pray in song when I'm walking the dogs or I'm in my car. I pray in silence. I pray right now that it is in part because we have made the rituals of this space, be it our order of worship, Holy Communion, Holy Baptism. We have made our rituals anything but artificial. I pray that we have kept them alive and meaningful. That here our religious rituals are bolstering a flexible faith, a fighting faith, a freedom faith, a faith that when our basic institutions, like the schools, continue to be so fractious, a faith that when we are in hospice, when we are in hospital, a faith that when we are mourning or when our loved ones come to mourn us, we will know ourselves bundled up, we will know ourselves watched over, and we will know ourselves always floating on the river of life. Amen.